When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Stuck in a dinner routine rut? Picking tonight's meal doesn't have to be stressful. Here's an idea. Let Cook Unity handle dinner tonight with premium meals delivered to your door. New menu drops, weekly recommendations, and a growing community of award-winning chefs. Cook Unity offers over 400 meals for every palate. Shake up your meal routine. Go to cookunity.com/rut or enter code RUT before checkout for free premium meals for life.
We got something weird going on. It's Hockey Hall of Fame induction weekend night. And then the National Hockey League stats show the kids have arrived. So we got the past and we got the future surrounding us right now.
Well, you're not putting those kids in the Hall of Fame yet, are you?
No, but the way they're going right now, Celebrini and Bedard and this group that are dominating the National Hockey League points rates is incredible.
You better, now we're biased because we're both Canadian, so we latch on to Bedard and Celebrini, but I'll tell you what, you better add Leo Carlson to that list, too, because you saw him Saturday night live. I watched that game, and then last night did the Winnipeg Anaheim game, and Leo Carlson was a monster again. He is an impressive, impressive hockey player, and then when you consider what Celebrini's done for San Jose, and then Connor Bedard, what a weekend Connor Bedard had. 4 points on Friday night and three more on Sunday afternoon. You're right. The kids have showed up, and the game is better for it.
But what a ride Bedard's already had in his National Hockey League career, from phenom coming in to everybody worried about a step back to now being on top of the world.
You know what? It parallels life. Darren, at a certain point you grow up, and it's and when you are feted the way he was feted at the draft and that first year, I mean, I still remember that first 10 days of his career where he was paraded around the National Hockey League, and I'm amazed. Some guys don't survive that, and now he deserves credit for surviving that attention. Year two was tough on him. Mm-hmm. Year two was tough on the Blackhawks, period, but he has come out the other side and is much the better player for it. And check the standings. I know it's early, but look where the Blackhawks are. The Blackhawks are in pretty good shape. Jeff Blashill's done a hell of a job there in the short period of time. So there's lots of positive stories around the league, and you can't help but wonder what the heck's going on with the New York Rangers.
I mean, that was the low point. And there's been a couple of low points, but when you get filled in by the Islanders on home ice, that's
except the high point is that, they've only lost once in regulation in nine games on the road.
And I didn't think they played that bad against the Islanders. They had a couple of chances that would have swung the game differently. So
Mike Sullivan. Mike Sullivan's got to be pulling that hair out, wondering how to score goals at Madison Square Garden. They have scored six goals in seven games at Madison Square Garden.
And they had a great chance out. Like 8 seconds into that game that a puck that should have gone in and didn't, and then they don't score at all.
Yeah. It's a strange time. But anyway, it's Monday of Hall of Fame week, so.
So we got a class of eight going in.
Yes.
We got Builders and Jack Parker and Daniel Sauvageau.
Well, you know, listen, Jack Parker, the moment Jerry York got in a couple of years ago, Jack Parker was going in, because those two are the pillars of college hockey in New England. They deserve to be in for the contributions they've made to the game. So, and Danielle Sauvageau, in my mind, has deserved to be into the Hall years ago, both as a player and then really as the coach of turning the Canadian hockey program around, the women's program around. So.
Brianna and Jen on the women's side, and then the class of four on the men's side. So we got a couple of guys that are associated with the Hockey Hall of Fame.
Well, they're in it.
Coming up.
They're in it. You know, they have their blazers.
Mm-hmm.
So they're one. Both of them have won the Elmer Ferguson Award as Hall of Fame level writers, and are always pretty eloquent about what the Hall means to them.
Do you know the secret handshake between Fergie Award winners?
No, they don't share that with with broadcasters and B with guys that aren't in the Hall.
Yeah, this is significant, bringing a couple of writers on with broadcasters.
Yeah, but the writers actually might speak better than the broadcasters.
We're tearing down some silos. Scott Burnside, Eric DeHatchek, coming up on 100% Hockey. Stick with us. Get into this with a couple of guys who know their way around the Hockey Hall of Fame. Scott Burnside, Eric DeHatchek.
Hold on. I can't believe they're not wearing their blazers. Totally. My goodness gracious. I mean, you know, we have them on. It's Hall of Fame Monday, and they're both award winners in the Hall of Fame, and they both have nice blazers, and they're wearing like is this the relaxed dress code, or what is going on here?
I didn't get the memo on the jacket, and because Eric's the veteran of the group, I always follow his lead, so I got the. I only got the memo casual Monday morning before the.
Us out of bed at the crack of dawn, and you expect us to have those blazers on? Are you kidding?
Hey, listen, I know guys that have slept in them.
The lineup at the coffee place this morning. Every time, the thing about this hotel is wherever you go, you stop and you end up talking to somebody you know in hockey. Mel Davidson's in the elevator going down. Kevin Lowe's having a coffee there. So you can never really get from point A to point B this weekend without having a wonderful conversation with one of your former peers or colleagues. And it really is one of the things I think Scott will agree, the social side of Hall of Fame weekend is what makes it. It's like a convention of longtime hockey people and those of us who are out of the game right now and don't get a chance to do that on a daily basis like you gentlemen do. It's a real fun weekend. So and we'll be looking natty in what, a couple of hours, Scott? Maybe
a couple of hours, yeah.
Well, we will decide whether you look natty or not.
Do you guys find that, and we'll get into the inductees and the honorees as we go along during the conversation, but do you find that this weekend is always a bit of a temperature test of the game, and you get into what's hot, what's not, and what's good about the game? Hat?
Well, yes and no. I think that... I mean, part of it sometimes, unfortunately, if you've been around for a long time, is you do lament about things and how they used to be, and maybe how things were better before than they are today. I have to tell you that one of the conversations that seems to come up a lot with people is about betting, because it's difficult to consume hockey on television now without being bombarded by betting ads. And so when you watch a game now, you know, I mean, when I was watching way before, I mean, betting and gambling was something that was forbidden, never talked about. And it sort of didn't distract you from watching the game itself. And so now you watch a broadcast and pretty much everyone is sponsored by one of the betting companies. And you know, you're instructed to do a parlay bet. It's been folded into the fabric of the show often. And as a result of that, it has in some ways become a focal point. And so I think it tends to sometimes distract from actually watching the hockey on the ice. Are people watching goals and assists? No, they're watching to see if their guy is getting two goals and one assist. So I think that is one thing that seems to come up in conversation with those of us who are at it a long time, the pre-betting and the post-betting NHL. And are we thinking enough about the actual game and not about sort of indirect outcomes rather than, you know, Toronto 4, Carolina 5, and how did that happen?
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, though. Why do you think the cap's going up?
John, absolutely. I mean, no one would dispute that. Of course, that's where all the revenue is coming in right now. I'm just, you know, but Darren's question was simply, is it a referendum on, you know, I guess today versus yesterday? Or maybe I turned it into that question. And that is the conversation that you seem to have with a lot of people. It's hard not to have a conversation about hockey without that at some point creeping in.
Yeah. And I would, to your question, Darren, I echo Eric's comments back when I was covering it, and I covered a lot of Hall of Fame weekends over the years. Truly one of my favorite parts of the hockey calendar. And I found, you know, in the last couple of days being in Toronto and having dinner and being out with people, it is a discussion about where the league is at. And maybe that's a function of, you know, we're 15 or 16 games in for a lot of teams. We happened to be out on Saturday night and watch the Oilers get drubbed by Colorado. You know, the Leafs lose two games in a row on the weekend, looking very listless. And part of the conversation was, you know, thank God the Blue Jays went on that magical run so that people didn't realize how ordinary the Toronto Maple Leafs are right now. And I guess for me, if there is an overarching, whether it's a theme or a discussion point, is the Olympics. And I, you know, it's so exciting to think about the NHL players being back on Olympic, it's not Olympic ice, it's NHL ice, but back at the Olympics after not being in the tournament since 2014. And there is a lot of discussion about it, I think, the buzz of, you know, especially with the Canadian and American teams, because they are so deep and there are so many really fundamental choices that both management teams are going to have to make because they have such great depth to choose from. I think that's been a lot of the discussion. I know last night, again, talking about Connor Bedard and Macklin Celebrini, could you take one or both? Or, you know, I think it's a great talking point. And I can't wait for the tournament itself because there are so many players who are going to get their first opportunity. And maybe I don't want to say new generation of fans who have never seen true best on best at the Olympics. And this tournament should just be wonderful, I think.
One of the things that I've always wanted, and it's never going to happen, and I'm going to get back to the Olympic discussion with you guys at a later point, because I've got a key question. But, like, there are four games tonight.
Yeah, I'm with you on this.
And I'm one of those guys. Like, I think I've probably been to the Hall of Fame event, 30 times, yeah. 35 times. I love it. To me, it's one of those. It's like the draft, where so much of the hockey world is under one roof, or used to be, and everybody's there for a good reason, and everybody's got a smile on their face. But with the compacted schedule, it's not even feasible anymore to think that there would be no games on this Monday night in order to try to accommodate the Hockey Hall of Fame.
Yeah, but it should have been. And, you know, I feel like, you know, old man shaking his fist at the cloud, but every year it's the same discussion. It's a night and a moment in time when the hockey world should pause and honor those that are going into the hall. This is a great class that's going in tonight. And I'm with you, John. I think it's unfortunate that the NHL hasn't found a way that you can clear the schedule so that everyone can just pause, watch the ceremony, listen to the speeches. It's powerful stuff, and I think it's unfortunate they haven't been able to find a way to do it, and it's not going to get any easier when you add a couple of extra regular season games to the slate. It's just, if it hasn't happened by now, it'll never happen. But I think it's a shame, and I think it's a missed opportunity that it hasn't happened.
John, well, you would know the answer. I mean, right now there's a game on Prime on Monday nights that's very prominently featured and advertised. Mm-hmm. How would you put the genie back in the bottle if you have a rights holder that has this exclusive content on a Monday night and it goes up head to head? Would you allow that one game? I mean, that is the one thing. Like four games this year, it seems like it's going in the wrong direction. At least most years on a Monday, you know, you meet your sponsors. Obligations, but that is it, so that you can have as limited a distraction as possible. I'm on board with you guys, and we've had this discussion before. It should be a night where there is no NHL hockey to distract you from the fact that Joe Thornton, Zdeno Chara, Duncan Keith, Alex McGillney, and the rest of the class are going in. But how do you put the genie back in the bottle, John?
I'll tell you what. I worked half a decade for this commissioner. These are the types of things that he would turn and look at you and say, don't worry, we can solve it. We'd solve it.
Okay.
You know, he would just, you know, he would find a way to massage the national rights holders on that night and say, okay, listen, on this specific night, we're going to give you a Sunday night window. And if you don't like it, you know, let's talk it through. And if we need to give you an extra game, I mean, there are, Gary has done an amazing job over the years of navigating through these minefields endlessly. And that's what he's paid to do. So that's the first line of defense to say, well, we can't because we have a Monday national game. Oh yeah. There's always exceptions to every rule in the world of Bettman. And that, to me, as you guys will know.
Well, that's well said. No, okay. Well, then
there is. So that shouldn't be a problem. That, you know, I would only hope that, to Scott's point, with, I know we're going to 84. We're also going to start September 20th, September 23rd, around there. I would hope that at some point, you know, that this issue would be rectified somehow, some way. We can find ways to put 16 games on one night. 16. Yeah. Can't we find one way to put no games on this night in order to try to make it that much more special than it truly is? Now, and I'm not being vindictive, but if the league ran the Hall of Fame, this would be solved. The league doesn't run the Hall of Fame.
Yeah. How would it be different? How would it be different? Because I've heard that argument before. I just don't know how.
Well, the league would just say, okay, it's that important to us. You know, I mean, it's amazing what happened when they decided they wanted to do a New Year's Day game outdoors. Yeah. Well, solve the problem. You know, there has to be, you know, if the NHL had ownership over the Hall of Fame, and I'm not suggesting they should. I'm not. I like the independence of the Hall of Fame because it's not the NHL Hall of Fame. It's the Hockey Hall of Fame. Yeah. But if the NHL had a higher level of ownership within the hall, this would be fixed. Yeah. Just my personal opinion.
Yeah. So they would just, they choose not to do it, the league right now?
Well, the league will say, we've got 1,312 games to do in 182 days, and we can't afford the Monday off.
Yeah.
They can fix it if they wanted to. They can fix it if they wanted to. There's a, you know, by hook or by crook, they could fix the system if they really, truly wanted to.
Yeah.
I don't want to lose track of your Olympic question, so go there, and then we'll loop back to the Hall of Fame class.
Okay. Just so, Scotty, you talked about, you know, I keep thinking, we hear about Bedard, we hear about Celebrini, you know, but in order to add those guys, even though there's two more roster spots, there are guys coming off. I'm starting to think that there's going to be more than one or two players different on both Canada and the United States from four nations. There might be four or five players different now rather than, you know, we're going to put this guy on and Travis Konecny's coming off. Now, he's just at the top of mind for me. But, you know, that those there might be a lot more than just one or two guys off this roster.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to me, it's this is, again, the great thing about having the Olympics come back into it and the, you know, this discussion, especially when, you know, it's whether it's recency bias or just the reality of, holy cow, this player A is playing, you know, off the charts. You know, Connor Bedard has 18 points in his last eight games, I think. He's now tied for second in NHL scoring behind Nathan MacKinnon. And Macklin Celebrini is 1 point behind Bedard. So I think you're right. And I think what will be interesting, because the Four Nations face-off was such a different animal, right? It, you know, you had the three games plus a championship game. It was very compact. I think it's fair to say, you know, when Bill Guerin was building Team USA and you had guys like Brock Nelson and Chris Kreider, and you know, there was a little, you know, some jam and a lot of veteran. There was an older team than I think, you know, take younger players, Tage Thompson, to, you know, a couple of other young, you know, offensive bright lights that weren't on the team. The Olympic tournament is different, and it's, you know, it's, you know, obviously it's longer. You got 12 teams. And I wonder if the thinking is going to be different for, you know, when you start to put both those rosters together. And again, it's there's no guarantee Canada and US meeting the gold medal game. I mean, I think, you know, for optics and, you know, interest, that's probably the dream matchup. But, you know, the Swedes will have a lot to say about it. There are a lot of, you know, the Finns are banged up, but there's a lot of good teams there. Don't sleep on the Swiss. They're going to have an excellent team. But I think your point's a good one, John. I wouldn't be surprised if there are three or four changes for both Canada and the United States when those rosters drop in early January. And I think it's great. I think it's great for the game and the debate about it. What, you know, and there's no wrong answer unless you don't win gold. And, right. and then the answer is completely wrong. If you, you know, that's the, I remember talking to Doug Armstrong when he was first named GM of Team Canada. It might've been leading up to the 2016 World Cup of Hockey. I can't remember, but paraphrase him, but he said, that's a good thing about being a GM of a Canadian team. You only get to screw up once, right? Because the expectations are so high. Now, Doug Armstrong's doing it because he does it well. He's got a really good, smart group, but man, there are a lot of difficult decisions and it's going to be fun to watch and see how it unfolds and how much recency bias there is and how much youth do you want, especially with the international calendar growing with the World Cup of Hockey in 2 years and so on and so on. So I think it's a great talking point. I never get tired of it.
Well, the lesson of past Olympics is from Canada's perspective anyway, that when you go with younger players, it's always the right answer. You know, think about the impact that Drew Doughty and Jonathan Toews had in 2010. There's an energy that these young players bring to the mix that I think can't be duplicated. So I would agree. I wouldn't call it recency bias. I think going with a hot hand is the absolute way to go. I you know, whoever is playing at the top of their game at the precise moment where you need to announce the roster should be the players that are on the team. You know, there's just so much up and down over the course of a player's career that at the moment where someone is playing with great confidence and just, you know, and Bedard and Celebrini clearly are that is catching. It is contagious. And I think that the management group is looking at that. And then, of course, you know, the question in Canada is always about goaltending. And Jordan Binnington was so good the last time that coming out of Four Nations, it felt like, well, okay, so number one is this guy, and then we'll fill in the gaps around him. And he, because I got him on my fantasy team, so I'm watching him a little bit more closely, mm-hmm. is not having a very good season so far. So it becomes a very challenging choice there, especially with the relationship that the goaltender has with the current general manager. So yeah, fascinating to see what happens. And my standard line about the Olympics, especially as it relates to Canada and now the United States, because of the depth of their rosters, is that there really are no wrong answers. There are just too many correct answers. And that is how you have to sort it out if you're running the teams.
there should be a few changes. A couple, 2 to 3 on every team, shouldn't there? Year to year.
Well, I was just going to say, and I don't know if it changes the mindset, because we're coming into this, you know, really what should be a golden age of international best-on-best hockey with the NHL committed to Olympic participation moving forward and the reintroduction of a real World Cup of hockey every 2 years. So filling in, you know, is there value in having, you know, we often have this debate if young players, and Macklin Celebrini is a good example of this. He played for Team Canada at the World Championships last spring. Is that a valuable, you know, piece of his resume then that, you know, build on that moving forward when you're building these teams? I know it's 2 years. And you say, well, what difference does it make whether he's, you know, if he doesn't go to Milan, doesn't mean he won't be front and center in 2 years when the World Cup of Hockey comes, you know, back onto the stage here. But I wonder if there is a thought process on having, you know, and Eric mentions, you know, to me, the Drew Doughty one is a great, great example. People like, and Drew Doughty talks about it, you know, with such, you know, really was a springboard to what is a certain Hall of Fame career. And I think it was Steve Yzerman who told him, you know, early on, he was so nervous. And Steve just said, I put you on this team to play your game. So play your game. Mm-hmm. And then he was one of the great surprises. And I'm with Eric on this, you know, I played a very important role on that team and in maybe the greatest tournament ever. With Canada beating the Americans in overtime in the gold medal game in Vancouver. So,
before we move on, is Canada in a crisis with its goaltending? It seems to be flying a little bit under the radar compared to a year ago when there was a lot of talk about it. And I think it's in a worse position now than it was then.
Crisis is a really difficult word because
we usually have summits with crisis.
Yeah. And I mean, problematic. It's been a problematic issue for a long period of time, partly because of the way other countries have been able to develop multiple elite choices in goal, the United States being first among them at the moment. But, you know, Sweden and Finland at different times and Russia have also been able to produce many good goaltending choices. And in Canada, you know, you have a whole bunch of fair choices. So I've long thought that, you know, like goaltending to me is a bit like coaching in the NHL. When people say he's a bad goaltender, or he's a bad coach, my answer is always no, he's not. If you're coaching in the NHL, you're one of 32 people who has reached the top level of their profession. Anybody that makes it to the NHL as a starting goaltender or an NHL coach is good at what they do. So it's not a question of good versus bad necessarily in goaltending. It's hot versus cold. And I think the problem with Canada right now is that the management group of Team Canada was hoping that someone would get hot. And in fact, the problem is that everybody seems to be running cool to cold. And I think it becomes an issue that you may have to actually fall back on past performance and rely on somebody finding their game between now and the moment that they drop the puck at the Olympics, which, you know, to be fair, still, you know, there's still time for players who are off to slow starts to get into a groove and to become hotter than they are today. But if you just step back and look at the big picture, I mean, how many times have we written about, you know, what's wrong with goaltending in Canada? How many times have we written about, you know, how do you fix this? And, you know, you keep interviewing people and you keep doing deep dives. And so far the answer has been, Canada collectively has not been able to find a solution. And then the other part of the question that always comes up is how exceptional does the goaltending have to be on a team that is as deep as Canada is? You know, frequently in the past, good goaltending has been good enough. And it may well be that that's the case again this year.
Yeah. I tell you what, Jordan Binnington made some key saves in that overtime period.
Yes.
Well, but yeah. I think, Darren's question, and I think you hit the nail on the head there, John, is that I don't think there's a level of concern because Jordan Binnington did exactly what he did at Four Nations, and that was rose to the occasion and played. That was an outstanding event. Mm-hmm. I think it surpassed all expectations, and that over that gold championship game against the Americans was a thriller. And Jordan Binnington rose to the occasion. And the fact that he's having a middling season for a very disappointing St. Louis Blues team, I don't think really matters. I do think it's interesting, though, how Canada approaches building the roster. You know, Logan Thompson's having a, you know, if I had to vote, and of course writers don't vote on the Vezina, but, you know, Logan Thompson might be the Vezina front runner right now, early on, but his relationship with Team Canada management and some of the coaching staff is, you know, could be an issue with, you know, what does, you know, how do you get over, you know, maybe some issues, you know, does that prohibit him from being named Team Canada? And, you know, like it's interesting, Darcy Kuemper was a Vezina finalist a year ago, again, off to a pretty strong start and such a, you know, he's, you know, terrific person. And I think it is going to be interesting to see how that, you know, how the final trio gets named. And when you give, you know, assume Binnington's in there, but it is going to be fun, but I don't think it's crisis because I think you'd say, well, we don't worry because it doesn't matter that Jordan Binnington's playing lousy now, or, you know, he's not happy or with his play or whatever it is. It doesn't matter because we've seen what he can do in this kind of moment. And you, the expectation is he could well replicate that in Milan.
Yeah, I'll put crisis on the shelf for now, but it's within reach. All right.
Yeah, that's it.
To be able to bring it back. We'll take a break. We'll come back with Eric DeHatchek, Scott Burnside on 100% Hockey, talking the Hockey Hall of Fame.
NHL TV is now on DAZN. Hockey lives here.
Here we go.
Watch every game from every team. The best players in the world. And the coldest plays on ice. Watch up to four games at once for the ultimate NHL experience. Sign up now at DAZN.
All right, I'll give it to you guys. Is there an overriding theme to this 2025 class? Because to me, they all come at this from different directions, Scott.
Yeah, no, I think that's very true. And I think it's why it's a fascinating class. I mean, you know, the whole Alexander McGillney situation, you know, long time waiting for this moment. And then now he's not physically going to be in Toronto for the induction ceremony, which is, you know, that's a decision. You know, somebody like Zdeno Chara, who, you know, was such a, like, just a, The stories about Char, when I think about him, I don't think of necessarily moments that he, you know, on the ice as much as how he was revered and the kind of leader he became and how he set an example for a guy like Patrice Bergeron. And to me, he's truly one of the ultimate leaders of the game when I think of, you know, sort of a Mount Rushmore of leaders. You know, I think Char is the kind of person who deserves that kind of consideration. And, you know, Duncan Keith is a player that, you know, had covered a lot of the Blackhawk runs when they won three cups in 6 years and spent a lot of time there. And a player who, in some ways, you know, I don't want to say he redefined the position, but he created, he became a very unique player because of his skill set. And even though he was, I remember talking to Stan Bowman for a piece on Duncan Keith and talking about when he first came into the NHL, and he would go to weigh-ins after, and he would shower hoping to build up his weight. He wouldn't draw himself completely, hoping to build up his weight because he was always so slight and slender. And, you know, would that, you know, hold him back from being the player that he felt he could be? And obviously it didn't. He was a world-class defender and the kind of, you know, such a critical piece of those Blackhawks team and Team Canada, right? You go back to the Olympic experience with Duncan Keith. So there's a nice mix and it's always a treat because it's a real smorgasbord. And you talk about all that, the entire class, mm-hmm. that they represent so many different facets of the game and tell, you know, they're individual stories are compelling in and of themselves. And when you put them all together, it's going to be a real treat.
Well, it's, you know, one thing that's unique about it is it's the largest class in history. So I've served on the selection committee for 15 years. And, you know, there was always that sense that you could put 8 in, 4 in the male player category, 2 in the female player category, and 2 in the builder referee category. But there never seemed to be a moment where that happened. You know, we had 7 a bunch of times. Sometimes we'd have fewer than that. So, you know, you have to break it down, I think, into the 3 categories, and each one tells a different story. In the male player category, to me, there are 3 obvious first balloters. And that's something else, too. You know, when people talk about the Hall of Fame, there does seem to be a special value put on getting elected in your first year of eligibility. Like when Jaromir Jagr eventually quits, and then 3 years after that, when he becomes a first year eligible player, that will be a show of hands around the room. 18 people voting, 18 hands will be raised. The discussion will last about 15 seconds. And then other times, someone's candidacy can be kind of an either or thing. So you start to weigh statistics and then international achievement and then, you know, intangibles, you know, what kind of a leader were they? What kind of a teammate were they? So, you know, when you look at Joe Thornton, I mean, he was the best playmaker of his generation. You look around the room when you're voting for Joe Thornton, and there isn't really a lot to discuss there. The same with Zdeno Chara. I thought Michael Farber's profile of him on TSN was spot on. You know, he asked the question, is he the most unique player in NHL history? And when the question is framed that way, the answer is yes. You know, it's a 6'9" player with a 5'10" player skill set. You know, Duncan Keith, too. I remember when he came up, I had a relationship with Trent Yanni, who was coaching in the minor league system in Chicago and really helped develop some of those defensemen that blossomed as NHLers. And he was a big supporter of Duncan Keith's and pushed because, as Scott pointed out, you know, he was undersized. That's why he was drafted in the second round. A lot of defensemen drafted ahead of Duncan Keith didn't even have NHL careers. And here is a guy going into the Hall of Fame. And then, so you have the 3 obvious first ballot players. And when you're voting, then there is that one last spot for those players that have sifted through the cracks. And I haven't been on the committee for 7 years, so I have no idea what the discussion was like. But Alex McGillney had been eligible for a long time. I have no idea why it is that this was the year that he was able to get 14 votes. And I always like to stress that to readers and viewers, that 14 out of 18, which is the bar that has to be met to get into the Hall of Fame, is a very difficult threshold to reach. 13 is not 14. When I worked for a company called The Athletic, we would do what we called a shadow Hall of Fame every year. And it was to illustrate the point that trying to get 18 strong-willed individuals to come to a consensus on someone where there was a lot of maybe yes, maybe no in the discussion is very difficult. And I think the last time we did this shadow committee, we had Curtis Joseph at 13 and didn't get in. We had Shea Weber at 13 and didn't get in. And then when the real Hall of Fame met, one got in and one didn't. So, but it made the point that it can, someone in theory could be only 1 or 2 votes short for a long period of time. And then the committee, which changes all the time because there are term limits, suddenly 2 new people come on the committee, 2 people rotate off, and the people that have been rotated on the committee are now supporters of that candidate. And that's how someone gets in after a long period of time waiting when they didn't meet the threshold before. Sometimes it's only a matter of a couple of votes. So I'm a spectator now rather than someone actively involved in the participation, which makes it fascinating for me to try to figure out the dynamic and then how I would have potentially voted in that situation. So that's the male player category. The female player category, I think we're getting better input because there are 2 women that serve on the selection committee right now, and both of them played for a long time. One, Cassie Campbell on the Canadian team, and the other, Cameron Granato, on the American team. And they have relationships with the players that have become eligible, and an awareness of everybody that's coming in behind them. So when it was just us 18 guys, you know, I mean, I covered a fair bit of women's hockey, but I think that you just get a more informed perspective today on the committee than there might have when we began electing women in 2010 or 11. I know, I don't really know Brianna Decker at all, But Jen Botterill, I covered that 1998 Olympic team. They were based in Calgary and wrote quite a bit about them. First time I met her, I knew her dad too, because Cal Botterill worked for the Calgary Flames as a sports psychologist. She was 16 and we met in a restaurant. I was doing a profile for her after a practice, and a 16-year-old sitting across from me in a restaurant, we were talking about the psychology of sports. And she was talking about how, you know, like sometimes, you know, you worry, you have an active mind in the night and you can't sleep. And then you have to find a way of getting yourself back to sleep. And I'm sitting there thinking, this woman, girl, is 16 and she has this brilliant insight into preparing for, I mean, she was already there at 16. It was a remarkable thing. And, you know, people often think about that Canadian women's team, which underachieved at the Olympics, and think that Haley Wickenheiser was the youngest player in the team. Haley was 17. Jen was 16. So, I mean, I've watched her throughout her playing career and now her work as an analyst. She is just brilliant. And so I was very pleased that she was finally able to clear that threshold, because I think that she's one of those people that I would say should have been eligible a long time ago. So, you know, this is a remarkable class for sure.
You know, Eric, you were eloquent. I know that, you know, you like the others, signed a confidentiality agreement.
Yeah.
But I just, you do wonder if it would solve a few of the issues if there was more transparency. And I know that it's an argument that has validity on both sides. And Jim Gregory, I used to sit in the office and have this argument with Jimmy, and Jimmy was adamant that what we don't want to do is embarrass the people that didn't get in. That's still going to happen.
Yeah,
that's still going to happen. And that was always his. We don't want people to think that if they didn't get in, they were failures. We want to celebrate the people that were in. So it's one of those things that you do wonder at times whether there should be greater transparency within the system to allow. Like you talked about Al McGillney, who I've been an advocate for a decade on, but we don't even know if he was nominated for those 10 years. We don't. And so that becomes the real challenge of where the hall is and what the hall needs to do.
Well, you know, having been the past president of the Professional Hockey Writers Association, and where the writers have for many, many years voted on most of the major awards handed out by the NHL. And we went through a process where, you know, debating this same kind of transparency. And now for the past number of years, I can't remember when we decided, but all the votes are made public after the award ceremony. And so, you know, to your point, you know, you know, and I know writers were reticent because they didn't want to face the backlash if they didn't vote for a player or coach. Well, they don't vote on Jack Adams, but a player that maybe was on a team they covered, or, you know, would it reflect badly on them, or they, you know, what all those kinds of things. But at the end of the day, what trumped it all was, you know, if you believe in your vote, then you shouldn't have an issue with having that shared. Now, Eric will have a much, you know, different perspective on this. I guess the question is, does the Hockey Hall of Fame owe any of us, does it owe the public that level of transparency? And I don't know that I know the answer to it, but that's the question. Because at the end of the day, it's a group of people who come together, they donate their time and their expertise, and maybe there's a rationale for not making at least some of it, like you mentioned, John, who's nominated, or any elements that would open a door onto the process for the public. But maybe the public isn't owed that by the Hockey Hall of Fame. And you know, that's a choice, right? But I'm glad the writers got to a point where all of the voting was laid bare, and I think that's a healthy thing. I think it was good for the association, and I think it was good for the awards process.
Well, first of all, I would have no problem. I was on the committee 15 years. I would have no problem having my final ballot published, that I voted for these players, in these categories, these builders, that, you know, that would be no issue for me. The problem would be, what do you actually release? So put yourself in that room, right? So you sit there, let's say there were 8 to 10 candidates in the male category. So the ballot comes to me, you know, if I believe that 3 of them are first ballot Hall of Famers, I check an X beside those 3 names. And then I look at the other 5 names, and now I have to make a decision between 5 names. Well, maybe I like Rod Brind'Amour more than I like Alex McGillney. So on my first ballot, I check Rod Brind'Amour's name, and then they collect all of the ballots and they say, okay, 3 candidates have successfully passed the threshold. But so we're going to do a second ballot to determine who wins the fourth spot. And here are the, you know, the number, you know, Alex McGillney got 10 votes and Rod Brind'Amour got 6 and Keith Kachuk got 2. And so now the ballots are redistributed and you sit there and you think, okay, you know, I don't think I can get my candidate over the finish line, but I think the other candidate that is leading the way is a Hall of Famer. So if I stick with my original vote, we're not going to get to 14. So at that point, do I switch and say, okay, I think this guy belongs in the Hall of Fame. I like my guy better, but it's not that I don't like, you know, McGillney for the Hall of Fame. So now I vote for Alex McGillney because we think he should be in the Hall of Fame. And we know the only way to get him over the finish line is for me to switch away from my preferred candidate. So at the end of the day, second ballot, they tally the votes and 4 of us have switched to Alex McGillney. And now he clears the threshold and you announce that this is the Hall of Fame class. Which of my ballots are you going to produce to the public?
None,
are you going
none,
to produce
none.
My Rod Brind'Amour
no.
ballot?
Or my no, not, we're not producing any ballots.
Okay.
We're not. To me, this is much simpler than that. I think there should be a process that tells us who will be on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
And so once I know which people are on the ballot, then I can continue that very public debate, like happens in baseball, which is fantastic. It fuels the system for another month.
Yeah.
and then, you know, the balloting exists, and you get, I don't care individual people on the ballot or voting record. I don't care about their individual voting record, but I do care that, you know, this person got more than got 14 or more, and yeah, this group didn't. And I would just do the final results of who got in and who didn't. But I want to know who was nominated, because there's so – I mean, Eric Lindros, and I know that you can't talk about this, Eric, but Eric Lindros was talked about for years, why is he in the Hall of Fame, and there was no guarantee that he was nominated in some of those years. There's no guarantee. And so that's where I think the system fails, is the transparency of who's on the ballot, period, because that will allow us to understand – a little more of the process. And quite frankly, what you just explained about the process is probably the best explanation I've heard in a long period of time.
Yeah.
And that's and that's what we need in order to create debate and create energy and create news and create and raise the profile of the Hall in so many ways.
Well, as I say, I would have no issues doing it, because I felt that in the 15 years that I served, I voted as honestly as I could. There was no strategic voting, which, you know, sometimes happens in any kind of an election. But I, you know, Jim Gregory, the conversation you had with Jim Gregory was a conversation that I and many other members of the selection committee had. And that is still the way the Hall believes. Mm-hmm. But there is, as you know, there's a change in leadership at the Hall over the past 12 months. And it will be interesting to see if it forges a new direction, and if it does go in a different direction, if this is one of the things that will come up to create more transparency, because nothing is ever cast in stone. The world is an evolving place, and the Hall is an evolving place right now. And I'm a big supporter of Jeff Denemy and Lanny McDonald and the people that were in charge for a long, long time. But you know, now, you know, Mike Gartner is the chair and Ron Francis is running the selection committee, and we'll just see where things go in the future.
we're pointed towards the exit here, but I'd love to get a story or an interaction that you guys had with Joe Thornton, who's going to be a major focal point of this class over the years. Your chuckling hat, go first.
Well, because, okay, so I do have a relationship with Joe that is greater than the relationship with other players in the male category, because when I was working at the Globe and Mail during the 2004-2005 season, I got maybe the best professional assignment of my life. It was the year that the NHL was locked out the whole time. So I got sent to Switzerland for a week and then to Sweden for a week to visit with NHLers who were playing overseas. And so I started in Bern and spent time with Danny Briere and Danny Heatley. And then I drove up to Davos and I had 3 days in Davos, and Joe's agent, and I'd spoken to him before, and I said, let Joe know I'm driving up and I'm spending time there and to find time for me to do this story. So arrive at the hotel, check in, go to the practice, beautiful building, you know, wooden ceilings. I mean, you know, fantastic. It was just like seeing European leagues for the first time was eye-opening for me after 25 years in the business. Anyway, I get to the rink. Joe is there with Rick Nash, and they know I'm coming. You know, can we sit and talk? No, we had the first snowfall of the season. We're going up the mountain. We're just going to hang out in the chalet there and sun ourselves. And I'm thinking, you know, but Joe said, but here's what's happened. We'll come by your hotel and we'll pick you up at night and we'll go out for dinner and we'll have a conversation. So, okay. So go back to the hotel, a little bit nervous about, you know, geez, I've come a long way. I need some time with these guys. 6:45, car pulls up. Joe steps out. He looks like somebody from the grunge scene in Seattle. Plaid shirt. We're here. Jump in the back seat. It's Joe, Rick Nash, a friend of Joe's from St. Thomas. I get in the back. They've given him a car. It's stick shift. He's never driven stick shift. It's snowing out there. The car's wheeling down the road to the, you know, that's like, oh my God, what's happening here? They've been there long enough that they've got this favorite restaurant. We sit down. He introduces me to the owners who come by. Eric, you got to order the special. And I said, well, what is the special? We're not going to tell you. And I said, well, I'm not ordering the special if you're not going to tell me. No, I'm not doing it. No, you got to order the special. And I said, I'm not doing it. I said, what's the special? Horse meat. Yeah. Horse meat? I'm not eating horse meat. So I ordered the pasta or something like that. Yeah. Had a fantastic 2-hour conversation. Joe was just effusive, forward thinking. I mean, just, you know, a beautiful man. Rick Nash was this polite young guy, didn't say very much, but, you know, it was clear whenever he spoke that he was an intelligent guy coming through the ranks. Just had fantastic stuff. You know, as a journalist, when you come back and you think, okay, I've got gold here. Now it's up to me. If I can't tell a good story out of this, then there's something wrong with me. And of course, as you know, Joe's had a long time relationship with Switzerland, met his wife there, spent summers there. And just, you know, and then every time I saw him from then on in his career, you know, we reminisce about that. And, you know, I mean, he's just this joyful, outgoing, enthusiastic guy, like just a fantastic teammate. So on top of the fact that, you know, as I say, I considered him the greatest playmaker of his generation, he was just a glue guy in the dressing rooms, played hurt during some of those Stanley Cup finals with injuries that should have kept him out and would have kept lesser players out, and just, you know, played through it, didn't complain, just after I left the committee, you know, Jerome McGinley was still eligible, Haley Wickenheiser was still eligible. I said, you know, even though it would have been, you know, a no-brainer, there are some people that you have a relationship with that you wish you had been there to be part of the process of putting in the Hall of Fame. Joe Thornton is another one for me. So glad he's going in. Looking forward to hearing from him tonight, and just you know, really pleased that he was able to get in on the first ballot.
Yeah. I will get when I think of Joe Thornton, and I have friends from St. Thomas, and we actually, our circles sort of interconnect through things other than hockey. But I covered the West Final in 2019, San Jose all banged up and lost to the St. Louis Blues. And some people wondered at that time whether it would be Joe Thornton's last game. And so I went down to the Sharks locker room after the the game and, you know, just wait, you know, trying to get, you know, maybe, you know, chronicle the final moments of his, and I believed he was Hall of Famer for sure. So, but he came out and it was, you know, Joe Thornton, he didn't care whether he was wearing clothes or not. And he didn't care, you know, he was very, very comfortable in his own skin. And so a lot of the ownership group from the Sharks and their wives were all in the room. And I think there was a sense of, it was a sense of the moment, right? That this could have been it for Joe Thornton and certainly may have been his final, and was the final game for, with the Sharks. And there was Joe not wearing a stitch of clothes, carrying the little nylon bag that they put their underwear and stuff in. That's all he had. And hugging everyone in sight, elder ladies, men in suits. It was a festival of hugs. And I just, in my mind, I was like, oh, that is so Joe Thornton. There's, you know, just he in his little nylon bag. But he was, you know, he was in his moment and so comfortable with who he was. And he was, you know, very effusive in you know, in understanding that, a, you know, moment in time for he and that organization. But that's what I think of when I think of Joe Thornton.
What pops into your head, Shanny?
Well, to me, the moment you ask the question is there is a side of Joe Thornton that none of us see. And he has been able to keep what he does away from the rink, with his family, in the community, yeah. So very private and yet so very giving. I mean, the stories around and after his retirement about how he's helped people with charity in San Jose, in the Silicon Valley, to me, created another dimension of what I thought of Joe Thornton. Yeah. 'Cause we've all seen the Joe Thornton that Eric and Scotty talked about. Yes, we've been fortunate to do that. But the fact that he has helped homeless, the fact that he has worked tirelessly to make the world a better place away from the arena is something that I remember one of the speeches, whether it was at his event or at Marlowe's event, you just went, wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's what Joe Thornton really is.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is a measure of the man.
So, and just, I'd like to add just a brief bit there, John. And I knew this, and you know, and people, you know, within the game understood this. And I had approached Joe many times, and became a standing joke with us that I wanted to come out, spend some time with he and his wife, because his wife very, like, really, you know, part. Equal partner in terms of being a catalyst to giving and all the things that he did. It's the stories are legion. And I said, let me come out. And he's like, no, I'm not doing that. And I was like, well, I don't even need to talk to you. I want to come out, spend some time with your wife. And he's like, well, I'll ask her. But and it became his joke. He wanted no part of that mm-hmm. kind of story. And to your point, he wasn't doing it to get any kind of accolade. But that was just like, and I would just send him a note every year. Hey, how about this year? When can I come out? And he's like, that's not happening. But he came to those things. He wanted no part of that kind of story, even though it was a real part of course, his personality and who he was. And you're right. It's an important part of who his legacy.
He could intimidate people though, on and off the ice. He could be edgy too. And some of those moments were some of my favorite moments of seeing that side of him, that competitor side of him.
Yeah.
It's true. Just because you don't necessarily think a guy with that kind of a big heart and that kind of an outgoing style has that steely edge. But let's face it, you know, to play for a long time in the National Hockey League and to succeed at the level that he succeeded at, you have to have that. And he does. But he masked it just in the same way that John suggests. He just didn't want to talk about all of the things that he was doing away from the rink because he was doing it for all the right reasons rather than the wrong reasons. So, I think we're all agreed that this is a guy that's a Hall of Fame player and a Hall of Fame person.
One of the great gatherings on the hockey calendar, Hockey Hall of Fame Induction Weekend. Thanks for joining us, you guys, and enjoy the festivities.
Thank you.
With the NHL app, you can listen to every NHL game right from your phone. And with home and away broadcast feeds, you choose your way to listen. And he scores! Whether you're at work, at the gym, or stuck in traffic, the NHL app puts you right in the action all season long. Every team, every game, everywhere you go. Download the NHL app and never miss a moment.
We don't talk enough about Joe Thornton's edge. He can bring it. And if he didn't like where you were going, he told you, which I don't have a problem with. But in this day and age, some people were a little taken aback by it. And I like that side of him.
Well, the fascination for me, Darren, is you're right about Joe Thornton. And Thornton gets in on his first attempt. And one of the other players that was always that way, never really liked stupid questions and would tell you it was a stupid question, was Alexander Mogilny. Mm-hmm. Al Mogilny was, he was a brilliant hockey player. And from that perspective, I think it really hurt him when he appeared aloof. And he wasn't really aloof. He just was intolerable of bad questions. But if you asked a good question, his eyes would light up and he would would be engaged in what you were doing. You know, the moment Joe Nieuwendyk, in my opinion, the moment that Joe Nieuwendyk got in the Hall of Fame, that paved the way for Alexander Mogilny. Both came to this league as prolific goal scorers. Both were Stanley Cup champions. And then both had to change their games in order to try to maintain their position within the game, and that was to become 200-foot players. And Mogilny, in the end, was a brilliant two-way forward, as was Joe Nieuwendyk, as is, for instance, Marian Hossa, who's in the Hall of Fame. And for Mogilny to take this long irked a lot of people. And now the fact that Elmo's not going to be there live.
Do we know why?
No. Perhaps it will be explained tonight.
I heard he doesn't like to fly, but you can get over that. He flew forever. Like there's ways around managing that for such an important event anyway.
Well, important for other people, maybe not important for him. Let's be honest. I mean, the pressure to put Alexander Mogilny in the Hall of Fame, we never heard from Mogilny about how disappointed he was. It was always, you know, a small cabal of guys like us that were yelling that Mogilny should be in the Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk when we meet again a little bit more about Anaheim and Colorado, because they deserve some love.
Well, to quote Jack Hughes, both teams are on a heater.
Heater. Yeah, they're rolling. Heater is a really good one, but rolling is the way we should go. We got to roll on out of here.
What's wrong with heater? I'm trying to be with the young people.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. You know what? They'll send you. They'll come and buy your groceries for you. That's how much you can hang out with the young people. I'm the same way, man.
What is this, Meals on Wheels or what? What's going on here?
That's not a bad idea, though. Huh? that was Uber Eats way before Uber Eats.
Tell you what, come and shovel the snow today, okay?
DoorDash. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I apologize. I do not have snow in front of my house. We'll talk to you guys next time on 100% Hockey with Millard and Shannon.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.